We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Amy Poehler. My new movie, Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, is coming to theaters June 14th, and it's making me feel joy and sadness and anger, definitely some disgust,
Rose,
and I think a little fear.
Really?
But I'm also feeling these new emotions like anxiety, embarrassment, envy, and ennui.
It's what you call the boredom.
Okay, that one was weird. It's going to be the feel-everything movie of the summer. Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2, only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly interview show where top chess players, authors, content creators, and accomplished amateurs discuss their careers and share stories and chess improvement tips. Perpetual Chess is a part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network, and we'd like to give special thanks to our presenting chess education sponsor, Chessable.com. For more information about the show, you can go to PerpetualChessPod.com. But without further ado, let's get to the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We are joined this week by a return guest, a personal favorite of mine. He is an author and renowned trainer. He, as a player, he was the 2002 British champion, 2007 Commonwealth champion. As a trainer, of course, he is one of the best-known trainers in the world. He's worked with many of India's top players, including Grandmasters Hare Krishna, Sethuraman, Adiban, and the young phenom Pragananda, among many, many others. He is a founder of ProChessTraining.com and Chess Gurukul in Chennai, India, and an author, most recently, of the insightful and challenging new book, Improve Your Chess Calculation. So we've got lots to talk about and are excited to welcome back Grandmaster R.B. Ramesh. Welcome.
Yeah, hello, Ben. Really happy to be here again.
Yeah, so happy to have you. And you joined me on the eve of starting a training camp for the India Olympiad. The Olympiad, of course, is basically the Chess Olympics, a team competition that will be in your hometown of Chennai. So Ramesh, we were just starting to talk before we recorded, and what you were telling me was interesting. So could you share what you will be doing in the next couple of days with our listeners?
Yeah, so the Chess Olympiad, as you mentioned, is coming to India for the first time. And it's going to happen in my hometown, Chennai. So I'm really happy about it. And India will be fielding two teams because it's usually one team, but because we are the host, we have the right to field a second team as well. And I've been appointed as coach for the second team. And it consists of players like Nihal Sarin, Pragnananda, Adiban, Gukesh, and Ronak Sadwani. And from tomorrow till the 19th of June, we are going to have our first training camp with the team. And Pragnananda, Gukesh, and Ronak Sadwani will be attending the first camp.
Yeah, so just a shockingly strong roster. First of all, for it to be, as you say, the second team for India. And to coach, to train players of that stature has got to be challenging. So how do you go about finding material for these grandmasters, fellow grandmasters?
Yeah, so I have to rely heavily on my experience. I've had a couple of decades of experience working with players from different levels. I've been a coach for the Indian team as well for the last 12 years. So I have had the opportunity to work with super strong grandmasters like Hari Krishna, Vidit Gujarati, Sashi Kiran, and even the previous Olympiad, we had Vishy Anand among the team. So I have to rely heavily on my experience working with these players. And I'm also, of course, going to rely heavily from the recently published book, Improve Your Chess Calculation. And I hope the players would not have seen at least Ronak and Gokesh would not have seen the book, at least not in full. That's my one of my hope. And I'm also like trying to study their games, trying to analyze these players' games from the last 3 years and pose them some interesting positions where they could have reacted differently than what they did in the game.
Yeah, well, that's interesting to me. I mean, these players obviously so strong and rising so fast. So when you look at the games of like Nihal Sarin or Gokesh or your all the time student Pragananda, what do you notice? Like, what do they still need to work on? I mean, they're all like knocking on the top 100 in the world and under the age of 21. So what sort of themes do you highlight?
Generally, like from what I have seen, like when I first got an opportunity to work with players around over 2600, and I used to think like, what can I possibly work with these players, and is there any way I can positively contribute, because they are already very strong. But then when I started working with them, initially it was with a lot of apprehension, but when I started working, I realized that they also have their own issues and they are not comfortable in many situations. And as a trainer, if I can identify those moments where they are not comfortable, and that is where the actual learning can take place. And I have seen, worked with Prag from when he was like 1700 or so, 7.5 years old kid. Now he's like close to 2650. And I have seen in the journey that at different phases of their career, they evolve. The kind of mistakes they make, it keeps evolving as they grow stronger. But issues still remain. And sometimes, like when opponent plays a new move in the opening, which they did not expect, and how they react. Sometimes some players, typically, they slow down considerably. And the next few moves also, they keep playing very cautiously, not to come out of the opponent's opening preparation unscathed. And in the process, you know, next few moves, they can quickly get into time trouble and make related mistakes. So this is one way. The other way to react when opponent plays a new move in the opening is you may consider like you have fallen into opponent's opening preparation, and you start thinking very negatively and start playing over defensively. So I try to identify such moments from these players' games, and there are many such issues we can identify when we go through these players' games. For example, when Prag was playing in Tata Steel Challengers a couple of years ago, I noticed that in the first few games, he was not changing his pawn structure. He was keeping the pawn structure very stable, and he was just moving around with the pieces. Even when one of the main reasons was the pawn breaks were looking quite risky, and he was avoiding those risky-looking pawn breaks. So once I saw this pattern emerge in the almost 3 out of the first 5 games, on the rest day, I showed him these moments where he could have gone for some risky pawn breaks, and he was avoiding them. And in a few instances, I was surprised to see that he did not even notice those moments. And in other cases, he noticed it, but considered them to be too risky. And then I showed him some examples where strong players successfully managed to play similar pawn breaks, and they got a very active position. And after that, in the remaining games, I could see like Prag was more confidently executing those pawn breaks at the first opportunity. So there are many things a well-trained eye can notice and we can bring this to the attention of these players.
Well, that's impressive analysis, but I guess that's why one of the reasons that Prague has had so much success. And I enjoyed a few of the stories that you told in your book, Ramesh, like such as this Smislav Rubinetti position that you show, that you showed Prague when he was 10 years old. Could you tell that story just of like the impressive work ethic and calculation ability that he demonstrated from an early age?
Yeah, I think like if we have a general look about how chess players progress over a period of time and across geographical locations, one thing I noticed is the base of the pyramid, you could say, like the number of people who come to chess at different ages is vast. Like probably like, let's say, 1 million players, 1 million newcomers come to the game every year. But hardly a few hundreds of them manage to become international masters or grandmasters. So the failure rate is pretty high. And I used to think it is simply because those few who become successful, they are more talented than the others. So it's just a question of talent. But after having been a player and subsequently a trainer working with different levels of players, I understood the training aspect is also very important, and a lot of the potential can be brought out successfully with proper training methods and work ethics. So that I started focusing more on these aspects. And one of the thing I noticed is even if we read Think Like a Grandmaster by Alexander Kotov, when he was trying to become a grandmaster, he wanted to find out that one area where if he can make significant progress, he can quickly become a grandmaster. And he felt the grandmasters were far superior to him in the area of calculation. And he came up with the tree of analysis, the candidate moves concept, and so on. And then he, as a result, he became a grandmaster very soon. And got me thinking many years ago when I was trying to become a full-fledged trainer. And in my experience working with many players, I understood that one of the things that prevents many players from reaching their potential or growing consistently is their inability to learn how to analyze positions. So they rarely learn how to analyze effectively, like how to manage the time, how to focus better, and how to get decent output after all this invested effort. And then among the analysis, analytical ability, the one key component is the calculation ability. So how we calculate variations. It can be a short, medium, or long variation. It can be a single line or multiple branches. But I felt this is one area many were struggling to learn and improve on their own, or even when they are working with trainers. And one of the reasons I felt was the lack of importance given to visualization skill. So in even in the good books that have come prior to my book on calculation, the visualization part is largely ignored, or it is just considered something like equivalent to talent. Either someone has it or doesn't have it. That's it. So I felt in my work with young players that at a very young age, the visualization skill can be mastered. And that's what I was trying to do with Pragnananda as well. And the Smislav Rubinetti game, probably like 20 or 30 pages of analysis in my laptop. I showed it first to the Indian team in China before a major event. And we had a very great time. So I worked on the analysis more and showed the position to Prague. And we tried to just keep the initial position on the board and calculate all the variations without moving pieces. And he was just 10 years old. And he was able to do it successfully, although I was giving some clues, guiding him in the right direction. But despite that, he was able to not only visualize the position in his head, but also find the moves. I think this is one area most players should focus. And if they manage to do it properly, it can bring about quick improvement in their analytical skills.
Yeah, it's again certainly been effective for Grandmaster Pragananda as well as your many other students. Now, Ramesh, one thing that I think that the adults struggle with is, like you've mentioned in your writing, that training should be more challenging than playing. You know, that training should be when you're away from the board, you should be working harder than at the board. And I know that you're working with a lot of top young talents. Your book, you mentioned several times, it's for ambitious players. But just like speaking from my perspective, and I think more broadly, I think that's one thing that adults struggle with is, you know, when you have a family and you have kids, like, you know, in theory or a job or whatever it may be, even if you're a grad student with a demanding schedule, you know, in theory that you should be training really hard, but it's hard to do that on top of all your other responsibilities. I mean, is it just that like you can't have it both ways? Is there any other advice to give in that regard?
Okay, so from my perspective, like I've been a player myself for a couple of decades and subsequently became a trainer. From the initial stages of my career as a trainer, I was very clear that I was trying to find ways to improve the human potential, like bring out the human potential and reach our targets, our ambitions in the most efficient way possible. So my methodology, my solutions, my whole outlook towards training is geared towards that. And it is probably not compatible with casual learners or players who don't have sufficient time to invest in their growth. So, and in this case, adult improvers are. So that is one drawback to my whole teaching philosophy. I am perfectly, and I realize that drawback in my suggestions. And but I think, like, even for adult improvers who have their careers, they don't have sufficient time to invest. Let us say, even if they can spend 1 hour a day on their chess. Now, instead of, if they are serious about improvement, if they are casually interested in playing a game, having fun, there is no need to even think about making a significant improvement in their calculation skills. But if they are serious about making some good improvement, and let's say they have only 1 hour to spare in a day, probably they should, instead of doing some casual work, they can consider maybe putting some wholehearted time invested for the full hour. Maybe that gives a better chance to make progress. And if they can sustain it for, let's say, an year, and if they are happy with the progress they are making, then they can decide to continue in the same path, and or maybe increase the time they devote to chess, or they can just move to playing casual chess.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I think that I fall in that category. An hour a day is about what I can spend on a good day. And yeah, I have to admit, there are days where what I do is more challenging, and there are days where what I do is not. But I have realistic expectations. I'd like to get better, but if it doesn't happen, you know, it's not the most important thing in life, which is also a realization that people have as life goes on and they have families and so on. But anyway, I mean, you've got so many great insights in this book about improvement. And one point you do highlight is you do feel like, despite what we might say about like, it's hard if you don't have a lot of time, you do feel like visualization can be improved more than people think. I'd like to hear a little more about that. I had a quote from it, but if you could just generally discuss that topic, because I think sometimes people could also just use a pep talk, especially adults.
Yeah, I think visualization is something like, let's imagine if I'm standing in a room and there is a wall right in front of my eyes, then my ability to see beyond the wall is limited. I cannot see what is behind the wall. But imagine I'm standing on a beach and I see water in front of me. Probably I can see a few miles ahead because there is nothing to block my eyes. So similarly, it is our own mental limitations. Many adult improvers, especially, it is possible that they have a low self-esteem as far as chess skills are concerned. They might be thinking like, I'm not good in areas A, B, C. My calculation is not good. My attacking skills are not good. my openings are not good. So they may have many such self-limiting impression about themselves. And with these are the walls in my view. It's like these are the limitations we have imposed upon ourselves over a period of time because we have not worked in these areas when we had the opportunity earlier. And then we start believing like we are not good in these areas. So one of my philosophy is like weaknesses as generally considered is simply absence of strength. So we have not acquired strength in certain areas and we consider we are weak in those areas. So weaknesses in my view occurs only after we have invested sufficient time and effort into learning an activity. And despite a lot of effort and energy invested, we still do not make the expected progress. Then we can say maybe we are weak in those areas. But many times what happens, we see even coaches of very young children, the parents, they say like my son or daughter or my student, they are not good in defense. They are not good in end games. So this kind of prophecies are made and they consider that children are weak in these areas. So I think this is a very incorrect approach. Until and unless the children have invested or an adult improver have invested sufficient time in learning a skill and still not able to do so, we should not consider the individual to be weak in those areas. So if we can set aside our insecurities and prophecies that we are not good in calculation or visualization, and if we can, with an open mind, approach learning visualization skills and through that improve our calculation skills, I think we can see quite significant improvement in our calculation skills. Just to start with some easy positions, not so hard, and just look at the position and try to find the answer in your head. And if you have come to a conclusion that you have got the answer, maybe check it one more time for mistakes. And I think this is a very important quality to learn in order to make good improvement in our calculation skills. Finding mistakes in our own analysis, that self-critical approach. And after checking, we are still sure we got the answer, then we can see the solution. Typically what happens in Leeches or Chess.com or various platforms, when we solve puzzles online, we typically only think about, let's say if it's a white to play and win position, we only think about the first white move and then we move the white move on the screen and the computer makes the black's move. So here we are not even forced to consider our opponent's reply to our first move. So this way of solving the puzzle is very ineffective. And I have seen many spend hours and hours and days and months without making any reasonable improvement in their analytical skills. So while problem solving, just not move pieces, try to get the complete answer correctly and then check the answer is a better way. And if we can do this with easier puzzles and then gradually move to tougher ones, I think the visualization skill will automatically get better.
Okay, great advice there. And I know you've written, I believe it was in your book, Ramesh, that unlike some other trainers, you don't feel it's super important that people write down the answer. It's okay to keep it in your head when approaching these exercises.
Yeah. So when I work with my students, it's usually in groups. I very, very rarely work one-on-one with my students. Even with Prag or Arvind Chidambaram, Karthik and Murli, these are all 2,600 plus grandmasters. We usually have group lessons. And in the same group, we also have players like 1,800, 1,900 level players sitting in the same group and solving the same positions. And at times what we do, like the stronger players will get the solution quickly and then I give them the next position and so on. But generally, like in such group sessions, I suggest my students to write down the moves and show it to me. Otherwise, they could disturb others. But in general, I feel the training should also stimulate a similar environment like in an actual tournament. And in actual tournament, we don't write down the analysis anywhere because it can become a tool to aid our analytical process. We may become dependent on writing down the analysis, and this is not possible during a tournament. So that is one of the reasons why I suggest my students not to write down the moves where possible. And it is also important skill to remember the analysis in our head. And then we also have to know, once we finish one branch, we should know at to which moment we need to go back and go to the next branch. And if we write it down, all this becomes very easy. But when we don't have this opportunity during a tournament, we could struggle.
Yeah, it's a really good point. It's something, as I get older, I certainly notice that when I'm calculating, I lose my train of thought more than I used to. Something that Pragananda probably doesn't struggle with as much, but nonetheless, it's good to develop those habits early.
Yeah.
Now, we have a question from a Patreon supporter of the podcast that's related to what we've been discussing. We've got lots of chess improvement related questions coming for Grandmaster Ramesh. But let's get to this one from Michael Favela. Michael, thanks for supporting Perpetual Chess. And he asks, at what rating is it appropriate to begin working with blindfold puzzles? And is there a particular type of puzzle that is best for players new to blindfold solving? So I'm assuming he doesn't just mean endgame studies, but actual, like, as he says, blindfold, where you're presented with a game and asked, presented with the moves from a game or presented with a position. But do you have any thoughts on that, Grandmaster Ramesh?
Yeah, my thing is probably like many are misunderstanding when I talk about the visualization skills and solving positions blindfold. I don't mean like you don't even look at the initial position. It is very important at the initial stages to look at the initial position, and then we just solve without moving the pieces. That's it. So we don't have to be blindfolded, covering our eyes, or we don't even look at the position initially. It is very important to look at the position. It can be from a book or on the monitor, or you can set up the position on the chessboard. You look at the position, think, but we don't move the pieces. We don't see the subsequent analysis. All the subsequent analysis is happening in the head. That is what I mean. Probably many are mistaking it to understand, like, we don't even see the initial position. No, I don't mean that way at all. And regarding the source for material, I think this is something we don't have to worry too much. There are many good puzzle books. One of my students, they asked when I was working with a young group of players, they were asking a similar question, like, can you suggest some good books for solving puzzles? So I shared my screen, typed in Google chess puzzle books, and we got like million answers. Mm-hmm. So any of those books is good enough. So we don't have to worry too much about the quality of the material, because any decent book should be good enough. We should focus rather on the quality of our effort. Like, once we see the position, how we focus on the position, how we approach the position. Like in one of the chapters, I have mentioned the common mistakes players make while calculating. And one of the things is like they don't make a list. They start analyzing whatever move that comes to their head. And this is one major problem. And Kotov had identified it many decades ago. So the principle of candidate moves is really useful that I have seen in practice. And the other is looking for forcing moves. This also saves a lot of time and energy, because I have noticed an untrained mind, they will go to some quiet move and try to make it work for many minutes, and they get frustrated in the process. So if you pay attention to looking at forcing moves, making a list, and then eliminate the ones which do not work, move to the next move in the list. So if we can start with some simple puzzles from any decent book, I think it should work out fine.
Okay, yeah. And to Michael's question, Michael, I don't know your exact level, but if you message me, I can probably give more targeted recommendations. And Grandmaster Ramesh, in our first interview, when I asked him for book recommendations, he rattled off about 20 off the top of his head.
Yeah.
So you can find lots in there. And I've mentioned before, but for adults who are, say, 1,000 to 1,200 level, one recommendation in particular is the Visualize course on Chessable, which specifically trains looking ahead in positions. And just one quick follow-up, Ramesh. So what about the actual aspect of playing blindfold as opposed to just solving visualization studies? I think a lot of adults might get decide that they want to specifically train playing blindfold. Do you think that that's a worthwhile investment of time, or is solving puzzles sufficient?
I think solving puzzles is sufficient. We have to be very clear about the reason for doing these things. For example, playing a blindfold game. It's more fun, and it can give us confidence if we are able to do it. But practically, to improve our visualization skills, analytical skills, just solving puzzles without moving pieces, but having a look at the initial portion is sufficient. For example, when I work with Prague or other grandmasters or many good players I've worked with, we never try solving positions blindfolded because we don't simply feel the need to do it. So working specifically on playing blindfold games, I don't think it's practically required. It can be a fun aspect. It can give us confidence if you're able to do it. But beyond that, I don't see a necessity to do that.
Okay. And one thing I'd add is your book, it's pretty challenging. There are, especially towards the end, there are some level one and level two type endgame studies that players, I would say, below 1800 can tackle. But beyond that, even though it's not blindfold puzzles, there are many puzzles where the variations go very deep. You know, it might be like an 8 to 10 move solution. So that, in a sense, is blindfold. As you say, it's just kind of like a more game-like scenario where you're not starting from scratch. You're starting from a specific position that's right there in front of you.
Yeah. So in the book, I have tried to give the positions for 5 different levels of players. So in every chapter, in every topic I'm discussing, I try to give positions for level 1, level 2, level 3, level 4, level 5. So for the players, and I've also given the probable rating bracket for each level. So for every player, it's better to first look at which bracket you fall under and then try to work only on that level positions. So if you belong to the first level category, it's better to first solve all the first level positions in the book and then go to the second level puzzles in whatever chapter we are at.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, and we've got a bunch of chess improvement Q&A, and I want to talk about Grandmaster Viswanathan Anand's recent exploits. But Ramesh, first we're going to take a break and hear from our sponsors. Listeners, I just got the latest analytical breakdown of my blitz game from aimchess.com. On aimchess, you can break down your blitz games, your rapid games from all of the major chess sites. It collects the games on its own and provides you actionable information and puzzles. In my case, my openings are good. My tactics are decent. I need to work on advantage capitalization. And one of the cool things about Aim Chess is it lets you practice it within the site. So I got to practice positions that I failed to win in Blitz against a strong engine. And guess what? I showed that engine what is up. So that's one of the many ways you can use aimchess.com to work on your game. If you decide to check it out and subscribe, you can use the code PERPETUAL30 to save 30%. You also can just use the link in the show description. So be sure to go to aimchess.com, check it out for free, and subscribe if you like it.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And we are back. And Ramesh, before we get back to lots of chess improvement type talk, I did want to talk about your compatriot, your fellow Chennai native. As we record this here on June 8th, he is half a point back in Norway chess. Now, this will be over in 2 days. This will be over by the time people hear this episode. So you guys will know how it finished. But whether Anand wins it, comes in fourth, comes in second, it's an amazing achievement for a 52-year-old. Obviously, you've talked in the past about how he shaped your career. He was an inspiration for your pursuing chess. But I'm just curious, first of all, does this even surprise you? Is there anything Anand does that could surprise you at this point, Ramesh?
As you mentioned rightly, like I came to chess largely because of Anand. When he became a grandmaster, late 88, early 89, that is when I came to chess inspired by his exploits, and I wanted to become a grandmaster like him. I retired from chess, active playing in 2008, and when I was 32 years old, and now Anand is 52. So even when I quit chess as a 32-year-old, I felt I'm quite old in chess terms. But playing at this high level at the age of 52, it's really amazing. Not many can keep motivation and energy level so high at this age? And in the last few couple of years, I have had a lot of chances to interact with him in person and also in chats. We have become more friendly in the last 3-4 years. And also I discuss a lot about how I can be effective with Prague's career, because he has been making rapid progress. And Anand is one who has gone through this journey himself. So he will have a lot of information to share and guide us. So he has been very helpful in guiding me on how I should work with Prague and so on. And so when the 2013 match against Carlsen happened in Chennai, I was a commentator in one of the TV channels during the match. And I felt very pessimistic about Anand's chances after the match. I thought, so it's time youngsters have taken over from Anand. So it's like one generation is taking over from the other. So I felt it will be very hard for Anand to make a comeback. This was in 2013, 9 years ago. And when the match finished, within a couple of months, he played in the candidates and won very convincingly. And he qualified to play Magnus again in the next year's World Championship. So I was shocked beyond comprehension. Like, it was amazing to me. I had almost given up hope on Anand after that loss. But within a couple of months, he beats every other player and qualifies to play against Magnus in the World Championship. So I was shocked back then. And thereafter, he has won many strong events. He has won the World Rapid and Blitz. And in the last couple of years, he has hardly played any major events. And I was not very sure about his performance here. But even in the Rapid and Blitz, which has happened just few weeks ago prior to this, and also here, his performance has been phenomenal. And he has also he has this capability to overcome his shortcomings when the need arises. Like, he's playing much quicker now, and he's playing more confidently, he's taking decisions more confidently, so he's able to raise his level as per the demand. And that is amazing. And it's if for the youngsters who are watching, and also for the adult improvers, he's showing age is just a number, and with the proper attitude and work ethics, a lot can still be achieved.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. I mean, I put this up there with, I mean, of all his achievements, this is up there with any of them to do this at age 52 in the modern climate. I mean, of course, there are historical stories of like Smyslov making the candidates and Korchnoi remaining strong, world-class into his 70s. But in this modern era, it's become increasingly rare. And here he is back in the top 10 on a 2700 chess. Now, I have to follow up, Ramesh, hearing this kind of glimpse behind the curtain of him sharing some advice that you could impart to Pragananda and your other prodigy students. Is there any bit of advice that comes to mind that you could share that Anand gave you on behalf of Pragananda and your other students?
No, there are many issues. Like when Prag becomes defensive after a loss, like sometimes I notice, like when he loses a game, in the next couple of games, he doesn't take much risk, and he used to react kind of defensively and also slow down a lot before taking decisions because the loss has had some impact on his confidence, and that is reflecting in hesitations in taking decisions and poor time management. So when I spoke with Anand, like, how should I intervene? Should I intervene during the tournament so that in the subsequent games he doesn't make these mistakes? Or should I wait for the tournament to conclude and then have a talk on this top subject? He said, like, as a player, he will be making mistakes. He's very young and upcoming. So it's better not to discuss these issues in the middle of a tournament, and rather wait for the tournament to complete and handle these issues. And so this has been very helpful as well, because we are not emphasizing on the negatives alone. Because when we try to correct the so-called weaknesses in the middle of a tournament, we can end up easily reinforcing them instead. So by talking about it, discussing it in threadbare detail. So that is something I found very useful. And also, like, regarding the opening choices, what should be the approach, and how we study the opponent's games to identify their weaknesses. So there are many instances, yes. And he also has shared many of his own experiences. Like, he has had, like, whenever I discuss a problem about a possible problem about Prague, he will say, like, yeah, I have been through similar situation. It's like reliving his past.
Right.
So it just calms my nerves as well. So I don't worry too much after discussing with him.
And Prague, of course, has a litany of achievements, but one that made a lot of news was his recent victories against Magnus Carlsen. As a trainer, what did it feel like the first time it happened? Were you shocked or not really at that point?
Okay, so when it happened, the tournament started at 10:30 in the morning, in the night, in India, and it went till like 3 a.m. in the morning. And I also work with many other players, and I have some regular students from the US as well, so for whom I take lessons at 5 in the morning, Indian time. So at the time, I was also writing this calculation book for New Inches, and I had a lot of work to be done. So we decided before the tournament that for around 10 to 15 days, we will be sleeping at 3 in the morning, so that Prague will be ready and he will not be sleepy while playing these guys. So on that particular day when he was supposed to play Magnus, he had already beaten Aronian in the first round on that day and drew with Anish, I think. And so this was the fourth game of the day. And I went to bed. I just wished him all the best in WhatsApp and went to bed. Woke up at 5 and saw that he had beaten Magnus. So the first time he beat Anand, I was sound asleep, I could say. But really happy that it happened. And it has given him confidence that he can take on the best players in the world. We knew that he will reach this point, but I'm just happy it came much earlier.
Yeah, just amazing. And do you ever, obviously, an ambitious kid is going to have dreams about things they can achieve in their career. As a trainer, do you ever let your mind wander about like what could happen with someone like Prague, say 5 years down the road? Obviously, he gets mentioned as a potential world championship contender in the future.
Yeah, like our philosophy, like even when Prague was young, I remember like my philosophy is always just focus on the work we do, basically like on the effort we put. Making ourselves better. And this has always been the priority in my own playing career, in all aspects of my life. I just try to give my best, not really worry too much about the consequences. And there are only so many things in our control. And most of the things are slightly beyond our control. So we have to focus our energy, concentration on things which we do, which are in our control. We can influence them effectively. So this has been my philosophy. So I remember when Prague was 10 years old, before he became the world's youngest international master. So myself and Prague and Arvind Chidambaram, who was also a young kid back then, we were having a training camp for 10 days. And in the camp, Prague did extremely well. So he had two IM norms at that point. So I just told him, like, Prague, you are analyzing very well. So I don't think you should be playing for IM norm. You can even get a GM norm if you put your mind into it. Then 10-year-old Prague immediately asked me, like, you have been telling me not to focus on results, not to play for norms or ratings all these years, and now you are asking me to play for a GM norm. What should I do? So this has been our philosophy. Like, he wants to be the world champion. I know it from when he was very young. But that ambition is mainly to motivate oneself to work very hard, because you have to work extremely hard if you want to become a world champion. There are no shortcuts to this. So, and he has to be ready to fight with the best players, not be afraid of them. He has to believe that he can beat these guys along the way. So I don't really spend time thinking what could happen in the future. So.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good attitude. And I know we discussed in a prior interview that you're a practitioner of mindfulness and encourage that with Pragananda as well. So I think that's a good sort of focus on the now type approach. Now, Ramesh, we've got a lot of questions to get to, so let's hop into them from listeners, from supporters of the podcast. This one is from Jonathan Evans, who writes in, and he writes, I just bought your book, Improve Your Chess Calculation. I look forward to reading it. So his first question is, you mentioned that it's a series of books, and how many in the series are you planning? And the second is, do you plan to do a Chessable course?
Yeah. Thank you, Jonathan. Yeah. So this is the part one of a series. And hopefully I'll publish two or maybe even three more books on this series. The first one, I wanted to start with calculation because I have a lot of experience working with different generation of players in this area. And I wanted to share my views on this subject. And I'm also planning to do a Chessable course on the same topic, the calculation based on the new chess calculation book. So hopefully it will also be out soon.
That's great. Yeah, I think it's a good course for Chessable because a lot of these calculation exercises people may want to come back to do more than once in order to appreciate all the nuances. And of course, there's a lot of variations that one could play through. So do you have any, I know that these things, it can be tough to put a timeline on them, but do you have any rough estimate of when the Chessable course would be coming, Ramesh?
I'm not really sure because I'm not so good at keeping up the timeline I promised to the publishers. It has happened a couple of times in the past. The main reason is like I'm constantly working with many players and it is taking up most of my time. So I hardly get time to put down my thoughts in a book format. So I took like an year to write the first book, even though I had the positions analyzed and checked with the engines, just adding text part and editing and checking the lines with the engines, I was not getting sufficient time to do that. So I'm really afraid to give a timeline. But the Chessable course, I think the discussions are on. Hopefully, I hope in the before next 6 months, I should be able to complete it. And then possibly in a year from now, the second book in the series should be out, hopefully.
Excellent. Well, we know you're extremely busy, so it's totally understandable and makes me appreciate all the more you're taking the time to do this interview, especially on the eve of this training camp, as we mentioned. So another question is from Michael Allard, who asks, he says, how do you advise your, and you actually discussed this a bit with about Pragananda, but he says, how do you advise your students to handle analyzing emotionally difficult losses? Often I find analyzing losses like this to be very disheartening since I'm reliving pain from the game. Are these the most important to analyze deeply since they had such a big impact? Or is it okay to do a quick analysis and not so as not to be discouraged? As an amateur, it's definitely not a fun thing to do, but I am motivated to improve.
Yeah, that's a really, really important question. I think generally, like what I have seen in my experience as a player and subsequently as a coach and now as an author, is most of the chess improvement books are written either by players from a player's perspective. Now, let's say a world champion writing a book, and he writes from his perspective as a player. He is extremely strong and he has largely forgotten the journey which he has had from the formative years. So most of the issues which were very important in the initial stages of his career, he probably does not even remember them. And this I have seen even when I discuss with Anand. Many issues, like he will, it will be like very alien issue to him. But I'm sure like when he was young and upcoming, these issues were occupying significant space in his mind. And so in general, I feel chess psychology is something a very largely ignored area. The players are not going into it in their books. The authors are not delving too deeply on these issues. And if some author is touching this issue, he's generally not very accomplished as a player himself. So they really actually don't understand the issue in a way they should have been before writing these issues. So I feel this is one area that can make significant impact on how chess training needs to be done at different levels. And I hope with my books and Chessable courses, I'll be able to share my view of things, which I'm not claiming to be correct or a one-stop solution for everything. But I hope it will start this process where the players, the coaches, they start giving the importance it deserves. And regarding the handling of disappointments, I think this is one of the key areas which prevents many players from reaching their potential. So I have thought a lot and discussed a lot with players from different levels and different generations, different geographical locations, and the issue seems to be the same. Humans simply don't like to lose. And the reason why we don't like to lose could be many. One, it can be one very common factor is the possible negative reaction from others. We fear like others will judge us poorly when we lose games. And I try to tell my students not to worry on this aspect. And it will be surprising. Most of us, we want to be looked up and we don't want to be looked down upon. So we imagine that when we lose games, others are judging us negatively. And this is one fear. The second is the possible effect, negative impact it can have on our rating. Like when we lose games, the rating can drop maybe 20, 30 points for players with a high K factor. So this is another factor they are constantly thinking about. Even when playing the game, even when they see the pairings, that if I lose to this guy, I'm going to lose 20, 30 points. So this is always playing in the back of their mind and they are not able to focus on the position in their game. So handling disappointments is extremely important. And for this, I try to suggest my students, like it's a matter of focus. Instead of focusing on what could go wrong and what can happen if things go wrong, instead, if we can focus our concentration, if we can focus on our energy into the position in front of us, then probably we can come up with better analysis, better quality of analysis. And this, in a way, will guard us against negative results happening as often as they are happening currently. And the other thing is, when things go wrong, how we react is also extremely important. It is very important. Disappointments are fine. Getting hurt, getting sad is okay. But it should happen in a way it doesn't affect our confidence. We should not start doubting ourselves after every loss. We can feel sad, we can feel bad, it's okay. But quickly collect your thoughts, try to forget it, distract your mind. Maybe watch some, if it's a child, you can watch some cartoons or you can watch some Marvel movies, whatever. Try to distract your mind. Stop thinking about the painful loss. Don't relive it again and again in your mind. Try not to overanalyze. Try not to think all the possible good continuations you missed. Instead of talking about this to others, I've seen like some players when they lose, they call everyone and show the game and say like, in this position, I made this mistake. And so it's better to quickly forget those losses. And simply by concentrating on something, some other activity, this is possible. And then we have to focus on the next game. So it is disappointments without affecting confidence is the key.
Okay, that's great advice. Yeah, and something that never goes away. Everyone has to deal with it at one point or another. So, okay, and we've got another question from Shubham Kumthakar. Thanks for supporting the pod, Shubham. And he asks, what are some key improvement realizations that you've had through your coaching experience? And he also asks, and you can pick either one of these, Ramesh, what are some common calculation mistakes that even grandmasters tend to make?
No, with grandmasters also, like one I have seen, there's a tendency to just straight away go into the first move that comes to their head is very, very pulling. But in their case, like they are trying to trust their intuition because they are so strong. In a strong player's case, the intuition is rarely guiding them in the right direction. So they try to, and Dvoretsky has suggested many times to trust our instincts. But I think that applies largely to stronger players, not at the lower level. Because at the lower level, the instincts are not so well developed, so well evolved. So it's better to rely more on the result of the analysis at the lower level, except in case of time trouble where we have to rely on intuition. But at the higher level, they can guide their calculation in the way intuition takes them. And regarding improvement realizations. One thing is like try not to categorize yourself into one small circle. Like I've seen many players, even at their formative years, they brand themselves as I'm a positional player or I'm a tactical player, I'm an attacking player kind of brands. Because once you brand yourself, then what will inevitably follow is you will try to play only those kind of positions. Like if I call myself an attacking player, then I try to keep attacking in every game I play. And even in my preparation, I will see only attacking games. And when I try to learn openings, I will try to choose only attacking variations. And when we focus only on one aspect of the game, over a period of time, we'll become weak in all other areas. So it's very important we don't brand ourselves into one category in the formative years. We can say, I like to attack, I'm good in attacking chess for now. And then that leaves the stage open for learning other areas as well. We don't close those other doors.
Yeah, that's a good advice for sure. And it's interesting. I felt like I was an attacking player when I was younger, and now that I'm older, I don't feel that way anymore. I do see people try to steer too much into certain types of positions, and it can be limiting for sure. And on the topic of candidate moves, you just want to share with listeners that you write extensively about it in Improve Your Chess Calculation, and there's definitely some great advice there. And we should mention, as is always the case with New in Chess books, there's a free excerpt of Grandmaster Ramesh's book on the New in Chess website, and I'll link to that so that listeners can check that out. We have another listener question for you, Ramesh, which is from Deepankar Ghosh, and he writes, he asked about Prague, but we've already gleaned a lot of insights about Prague, so I'll focus on the second part of his question, which is, he says, Divya Deshmukh has been doing well in her recent tournaments. For any youngsters, I'm not one myself, what are some qualities or training methods that you can learn from her recent success?
I think I worked with Divya Deshmukh as well for many years, and currently she is working with Coach Srinath Narayan. And from my experience, I have seen like even Divya. I mean, all the young players who are doing well, because Deepankar has identified himself as a young player himself. So I will talk from that in that context. So for young players, it's important to. One, as I mentioned before, don't brand yourself into one category. If you feel that you are good in a particular area, work more in that area, be more confident, gain experience, and then start working on other areas as well. So it is something like if you are 16-year-old, you have not yet learned how to drive a car. So you cannot say, I'm weak in driving. Right? We have simply not even made an effort to learn driving. So you have to keep yourself open that you can learn any aspect of the game. If you have sufficient interest, invest sufficient time and energy into learning it. Chess is a learnable skill for a very large extent. So we have to believe in this and try to learn all aspects of the game, especially areas which we don't feel comfortable or we don't like. For example, there are players who say like endgames are boring. I don't like, I hate endgames. So it's very important for such players to make special effort into learning endgames. So if we start avoiding areas, then we will become weak in those areas and our growth will be curtailed after some time. So that is one thing I would say. And you have to invest time. If you're young, you don't have too many responsibilities in your life yet. So you can afford to spend more time on your chess improvement if that is your passion. So try not to have any shortcuts. And also one other suggestion is not to outsource your learning to coaches or books. You have to learn the game through your own effort. And that can be done by asking critical questions when you're looking at games or solving positions. Ask yourself why this move is played, what principle they are trying to apply, are there any calculation behind this move? So try to ask critical questions and try to provide solutions yourself. This self-learning is also extremely important.
Yeah, I enjoyed your anecdote in the book where obviously you're one of the most renowned trainers in the world. So you mentioned that sometimes new students will come to you and they feel that because of your stature as a trainer, they can just work with you once a week and then they'll get better, you know, but you have to explain to them that doesn't, no matter who you are, no matter who your trainer is, it's the person doing the work on their own that that will lead to most of the progress.
Yeah.
Sad truth, but but I mean, hopefully people enjoy the process. Ramesh, we need to take one more break to hear from our sponsors, and then I'd like to discuss the book a little more and hopefully get your thoughts on the candidates too. Listeners, it's finally here. Shereshevsky's Endgame Strategy, one of my favorite chess books of all time, is getting the Chessable treatment, revised and expanded, and the video presentation is done by none other than 2018 U.S. champion Grandmaster Sam Shanklin. And guess what? They have a free one-hour video that you can check out on the principle of two weaknesses done by Shanklin himself. So that's just one of the many offerings from Chessable.com. They also, of course, are constantly dropping new opening, endgame, tactics courses, all of which feature their proprietary move trainer technology to help you remember what you learn. So the links for anything mentioned, as always, are in the show description. So be sure to check out Chessable.com for endgame strategy and all of their other new material.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
And we are back. And there's so much good stuff in Improve Your Chess Calculation, but I did highlight a few quotes that I thought it might be fun for you to just sort of expound upon. So are you up for me reading a quote or two, Ramesh, and then you could share, maybe elaborate on it a little bit?
Sure.
Excellent. So one thing that caught my attention is you write, "I have personally trained players with ratings in the range of 1400 to 1800 to analyze variations that players of previous generations with a rating range of 2200 to 2400 were unable to do. This is one of the reasons my students in the 9 to 14 age group can quickly become international masters or grandmasters. With proper training, they can be taught to analyze at a much higher level than was thought possible earlier. Unfortunately, the limitations we set on our mind also grow with our age."
Yeah. So I think, like, as I mentioned, Koto, he identified calculation as one area where if he can make significant progress, he can become a grandmaster. And I was very good in calculation when I was young, when I was new to the game. That was one of my core strength areas. But when I read Think Like a Grandmaster and subsequently the book by John Nunn,
Secrets of Practical
Secrets
Chess.
Of Practical Chess. He also takes Koto's suggestions to the next level. There were some limitations, there were some corrections that can be made in his way of thinking. And subsequently, in the book Attack and Defense by Dvoretsky, Krasenko had written an article, Wandering in the Jungle. In that article also, he tries to give his own view on these issues. So I think, like, this is one area where we can work properly at a very young age. And if we train properly, it is possible to improve very quickly. And many of the young children I work with, even when they are like 8, 9, 10 years old, they can start visualizing pages of analysis in their head without moving pieces. And when they are able to do this and see for themselves, it is through their own effort they are able to do these things. It gives a tremendous boost to their confidence. So that's one of the reasons why Prague became an IM at the age of 10, a GM at the age of 12, because he has seen for himself what his mind is capable of doing. And many of the typical limitations one imposes, like, I'm not good in this, I'm not good in that. So I try to teach them, like, whatever you want to learn, you can learn, but you need to put the effort. I think this is one of my key reasons for being a successful coach, I would say. So for all the young children out there, don't set limitations. Push your limits. There are no limits. It's only in your mind.
Okay. And what about for our older listeners, Ramesh? What would you say to them?
So for older things like older adult improvers, this is a very, very serious topic, I would say. Again, as I mentioned earlier, the psychology is very largely ignored. And people see only improvement in terms of technical things. Like, I'm not good in calculation. So if I become good in calculation, then I'll become a good player. I'm not good in attack. If I become good in attack, I'll become a good player. So this is how they view things. But if we don't go into the psychology, what prevented us from becoming good in these areas where we want to grow? For example, if I'm not calculating well, I want to improve my calculation. Have I put enough effort earlier in my career at any point of time? Let's say when I was 10-year-old or 10 to 15-year-old or 15 to 20-year-old, whatever. So had I invested time in earlier part of my career to make progress in calculation or not? That is one thing. And second, if not, then we are still like that 16-year-old who has never tried how to drive. We are in that situation. So now what could be the possible limitations as we grow older? One, when young, we have very less experience about life in general and not many negative experiences we have gone through. So that makes our mind very receptive, very confident, sometimes arrogant. But these are all good when you are young and you are very hopeful that you can accomplish whatever you set your mind to, because you have not had many negative experiences in your life. So you don't become a pessimistic person when you're young. It's very rare.
haven't been beaten down yet.
Yes. But as you mature in life, have a variety of experiences, go through difficulties, have taken a lot of beatings in your real life, in your career, and possibly in chess as well, then that can moderate our self-confidence. It can have a moderating impact on our self-confidence. And we start setting limitations. I'm not good at this. I'm not good at that. I cannot do this. I don't like this. So our likes and dislikes, our limitations, they become firm and we start believing them. And the more we start believing in our limitations, they become barriers in the learning process. If I think I'm not good in calculation, then it is very difficult to learn calculation. Not because I cannot learn calculation, because I believe I cannot become good. So that will always be like a stone tied around the swimmer's leg. So even if you practice swimming, you build your muscles, the stone will still do its job. So unless you can untie the stone, and with your current strength, you can swim better without any training. So the limitations, we build many such barriers to learning as we grow. I think like we start getting doubts about our memory. We start getting doubts. Maybe at this age, I cannot remember. At this age, I don't think I can learn. At this age, I don't think I can do this. So these limitations, I think, will be the major barrier to learning.
Okay. Yeah, that's great advice. I'd certainly I'll leave it there because we have another quote to get to. So you talk about the drawback principle, and I'll read a quote. When we pay attention to the good side of a coming move by the opponent and do something about it, we call this prophylactic thinking. But many moves also have a bad side to them. Suppose we can identify the drawback of the opponent's previous move and do something about it to our advantage. This is called the drawback principle. Humans had enjoyed the benefits of gravity before Newton codified it. Similarly, all the strong chess players have been applying this kind of thinking in their games. Prophylaxis is primarily valuable for static positions. Drawback is very effective in dynamic positions.
Yeah. So this is, again, another principle which has been largely ignored. Everyone has spoken about prophylaxis. Whenever they talk about positional chess, the first thing they talk about is prophylactic thinking. And unfortunately, like the other side of the coin has been largely ignored. Like when opponents make mistake, because as I said, the books are written largely by players, and even though they are applying certain technical things in their different thinking methods when they are thinking in a game, they are not able to make theory out of this. They don't identify the process and explain them. So I think this is the drawback principle, which is basically looking for the negative side to the opponent's previous move, is also equally important like the prophylactic thinking. But in prophylactic thinking, like we already have some advantages going in our favor. For example, in a static position where we are slightly better, the position is already in our favor, and our opponent can have only one or two ways to create counterplay. And if we can identify those counterplay at the right moment and curtail it, then our advantage remains for longer. And then once our opponent's counterplay is negated, we can keep improving our position and the advantage grows. But in complex situations where things are more forcing in nature, in dynamic positions, I think the principle of drawback is extremely important. And it is the way I explain to my students is like drawback principle is like trying to shoot a bird which is flying in the air. So, for example, like you load the gun, and when you are loading the gun, the bird will be here. And when you're in the process of loading, the bird is already flying. And so you cannot be aiming where the bird was when you were at the process of loading the gun. So as you load the gun, the bird is moving. And so you have to aim accordingly, right? So basically, yeah, you have to follow the opponent's move. And with each move, he is making some compromise. And we have to identify the new compromise that has been made. So we would have played a move with a particular idea on the previous turn. And for our move, our opponent would have reacted in a particular way, which would have created a new problem for him. So we have to react to the new issue he has created. That's the concept of drawback.
Great. Yeah. And you've got some great examples of it in the book. I think a helpful phrasing for amateur players might just be to ask, like, what has changed in the position given the move? And I think that often, like, pawn moves in particular obviously get highlighted because pawns don't move backwards. And as a follow-up, Ramesh, in a forthcoming podcast, a friend of the pod, Christopher Chabrie, had a question about differentiating static and dynamic positions, which, of course, you talk about in your book in as well as your other materials. And I think he was particularly interested in, say, you're calculating a variation. You talk in your book about there are situations where someone just stops calculating too early. You know, they stop at a certain point and then they miss a follow-up for the opponent. So Christopher was looking for any sort of guidance about, like, when in a variation you've reached a static position, how someone can know that it's safe, air quotes, to stop calculating for a given position.
Yeah, so one is like if there is an obvious gain in the analysis. For example, you start calculating a variation and at one point you are gaining material. Let's say you win a pawn. Then probably that's a good moment to stop the analysis because there is a gain to our whole effort. And then you can stop the analysis there and try to evaluate. But we also have to see sometimes at the higher level, even if we win a pawn in a variation, our opponent's pieces become very active in the process. Earlier, his pieces were passive and the material was equal. But at the end of the variation, we are winning a pawn, but our opponent's pieces become active. Or, for example, we have a good attack going against the opponent king. And after a forced sequence of moves, we are winning a pawn. But our attack slows down and the opponent's king becomes slightly safer than it was before. So in such moments, the evaluation becomes very critical. And you can say I won a pawn and stop the analysis and thinking we are better. Or many times the strong players would say, no, winning the pawn here is not worth it because my opponent's pieces are becoming more active, or that will give him compensation in the long run, which is not quantifiable. Or my opponent's king becomes safer, my attack has slowed down, so I don't want to win this pawn. So the evaluation is very critical. And so that means how we evaluate the position, where we stop the analysis, is the key. If you are able to confidently and reasonably correctly evaluate a position in our favor, then that is a good point to stop. But this is something we need to learn through practice. And the other thing, other indication could be where the forced moves are running out. So forced moves are check capture threat, and I also add pawn breaks with my students. I consider pawn breaks as forcing moves as well. So when the forcing moves are running out, that is probably a good moment to stop the analysis, because whatever analysis we do beyond that point could be in the realm of our own imagination, and they are not forced. So probably that is another indication where we have to stop the analysis.
Okay, great advice. Yeah, and for more on the art of evaluation, there will be a forthcoming podcast with Grandmaster Eugene Perelstein and FM Nate Solon on that topic, discussing their book. Now, Ramesh, I know you're a busy guy, so we don't want to keep you too much longer, but we've got a couple candidates-related questions. This will come out just 3 days before it starts. And the first one relates to Alireza Firouzja. So this question is from Eiko, and he writes in and says, first, I'd like to say I enjoyed the excerpt from your new book so much that I bought the book from the Forward Chess app. It's a joy to read it. My question is, what are your thoughts about Firouzja's rapid improvement? In the recent years, we've seen many hardworking talents like Prag, Nihal, Gukesh, Kaimar, and so on, and they've slowly passed 2,500 and then 2,600, yet to pass 2,700. But Firouzja suddenly passes everyone to reach 2,800. Is there any explanation for this? And lastly, what are your thoughts about Alireza's chances in the upcoming candidates?
I think a couple of issues here. One, it's not fair in my view to compare one player with the other, but I understand the world views differently on this. I'm fine with it. regarding Alireza, he has been showing phenomenal progress, and unfortunately has not been as active in the last, probably since the lockdown, and him moving from Iran to France has not been very active. But I have been studying his games as well when he was making that progress, reaching the 2800 mark. One thing is like regarding Prag, Nihal, Gukesh, Kimer, and so on, they also lost a couple of years. For example, Prag, when the lockdown happened, he was 14 years old and he was already 2600. And then when the lockdown was finishing, he's already like a 1600 with the same rating, 16-year-old with the same rating. Same happened with Firouzja as well. But when Firouzja was going towards 2800, he did not have to go through this couple of years break in between. And from what I have seen, all the players we have mentioned, the rating has been growing steadily. And with every tournament they are playing, they are consistently improving their rating. So it remains to be seen in the next 1 year how things pan out. Because I think Prag is 16 years old now. Gukesh is just 15. So they probably have like a couple of years before they reach what Alireza has done. So if they're able to reach 2800 levels, then it's not such a bad thing. And Alireza has been a phenomenally active player. His opening preparation has been very good, and he handles complicated situations very well. But there are still some areas of concern. For example, his loss against Magnus from the white side of Rylopas, it showed some of his shortcomings in the game. Like Carlsen, he just won without much effort, you could say, positionally outplayed him. So there are some areas of concern in Alireza's arsenal, but he's very young. I'm sure he would have noticed, his team would have noticed these issues as well, and they'll be working on those issues. And regarding his chances in the candidates, I think he has very good prospects, but as I mentioned, has not been very active recently. And remains to be seen what impact it has had in his preparation. I think his opening preparation, he might come up with a lot of surprises, new openings. But whether the rustiness is set in or not remains to be seen. And I just hope he will be a worthy challenger to Magnus in the coming World Championship.
That would be great if that happened. Yeah. That would be fascinating. Is there someone that you consider to be the favorite in the candidates, Ramesh?
Generally, like I've mentioned in many interviews, like even if tomorrow Prag and Magnus play, or Prag and any other player plays a game, I wouldn't pick a favorite. I just want the best player to win, or the one who played a good game to win. So no favorites in any matches or tournaments.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, we'll just enjoy the spectacle. Yeah. And we had one more listener question, which is from Deshaun Solomon. And this one is kind of unrelated topic, but he asks if you think it was right to ban Indian players from competing in the British Championship as a Indian who's a former British champion.
No, I think it is not for me to judge these things. Every country should have the freedom to form their own rules on how their national championships should be held. And England Association, they have taken that decision, and I respect it fully, and I understand the reasons for taking such decision.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And the last topic, Ramesh, is I was just sort of, the Olympiad, of course, is coming up in Chennai in July. And obviously, we've been talking about all of these top young Indian players, and you did a really interesting interview with Durkyantan Guzuntum in a recent New In Chess magazine that I definitely recommend listeners check out. And you talked about what you felt like one of the reasons that India is doing so well is that things don't come easily to Indian players. India still being a developing country, you felt that it really motivates players to try to achieve greatness. But I was curious, you also mentioned that there are just chess academies all over Chennai. So I was just curious if you could just describe for our listeners the state of chess in India. I think obviously we're impressed with the stature of players, but also impressed that when the Olympiad was no longer going to be held in Russia due to the Russia-Ukrainian war, very quickly the funding came together to organize it in Chennai. So I'd love to hear more about sort of just the on-the-ground perspective of the chess explosion in India.
Yeah, so chess has been growing phenomenally in the last couple of decades, more so in the last decade, I would say, largely due to, one, the exploits of Anand. He has been world champion not once, but five times. So every time he becomes a world champion, it renews the interest in the game, and a new crop of young players come to the game. So that is, he has been a major inspiring factor. And the federations, the National Federation, the All India Chess Federation, and also India is divided into multiple states, and each state, most of the state federations, they are quite active in organizing different age category tournaments and the local open tournaments. And this gives a lot of playing opportunities for the Indian players. And also, as I mentioned, there are many academies blooming because not every chess player is able to make a career as a player. So at some point, they want to earn more money, make a living by turning into coaches, and they start their own academies. And this has had a very positive impact because the lessons learned from one generation is transferring to the subsequent generations. So, and also, like, they are able to reach to many young children. So, and all out of this large pool of competition, we are getting few players, young players, who are able to make a big difference at the international level as well. And yeah, so that's a few reasons why chess is growing. And seeing all this success, more private investors are coming in, more sponsorship is coming in for players, for tournaments. And when the Olympiad was cancelled in Russia, then ASF found an opportunity that we could do something big in India. So we have been looking for such opportunities. And luckily, when the current Olympiad cancelled, Srinath Narayanan and ASF Secretary Sir Bharat Singh, they got an appointment with the Tamil Nadu Chief Minister. Tamil Nadu is the state where Chennai is the capital, where myself, Vishwanathan, and where the Olympiad is going to happen. And within a day, they gave go-ahead. They agreed that they will fund the Chess Olympiad. So that's a fantastic news. And the venue is going to be Mahabalipuram. It's like a few kilometers away from Chennai, and it's by the beach, and it's one of the oldest temples in the world. It was built by the shore, and that's one of the famous tourist spots. And there are many good hotels, resorts in that area. So I think it's a fantastic location for the Olympiad. And I believe most of the work has already been completed. I visited the venue a few weeks ago, and already all the teams, the Indian Federation, which is based in Delhi, they have already moved to Chennai, and all the officials, they are staying. Everyone has been given different responsibilities, and most of the work is already complete. So I'm sure the players and officials and accompanying persons who are coming to India will have a great time.
That's amazing. And for any listeners newer to chess, the Olympiad is just such a fun event to see all the top players. I mean, it's singular in that, like, out of the top, the highest percentage of, say, the top 1,000 players of the world are in one room. that you will ever see. And, you know, you get interesting matchups, obviously, because of the team dynamic and increased team spirit. So I commend everyone who helped that come together, and can't wait for the event. Now, Ramesh, it being in your hometown, I know you'll be helping coach the Indian women's team. Will you be sleeping in your own bed, or will you be getting a hotel for the event?
So interestingly, like a couple of months ago, when I was talking to Anand, we met in a public gathering and we were discussing about the Olympiad. He said, like, I just hope I'll get a nice room by the beach where I can
right.
go for a walk, go to hit the gym, hit the swimming pool every day, because Anand will not be joining the Indian team as a player. He'll be mentoring the Indian teams. So he was talking about the same issue.
That's funny.
So, and I'll be coach for the second team, not the women team. So India will be hosting two teams for men and two teams for women. And I'll be coach for the second team.
Okay, yeah, sorry. You had mentioned that earlier. My apologies. And the very last question, Ramesh, as I mentioned earlier in our previous interview, you rattled off about 20 book recommendations. And of course, there's recommendations scattered throughout Improve Your Chess Calculation. But I did want to ask, because I know you try to stay up with the literature, if there's any books that have come out in the past 2 to 3 years since our prior conversation that have caught your attention.
I think many of the books... all quality chess books are pretty good, especially the Gelfand's book on that series of three books. They are extremely good for all levels of players. And earlier I used to recommend Yusupov's nine book series. They are pretty good even now for especially players probably around 1200 to 2200 bracket. They still hold good. And I have not read... many of the recent books.
I could ask you about a couple that come to mind for me. Like, have you read Silicon Road to Chess Improvement?
To be honest, like, I stopped reading books for quite some time now, because as a trainer, I wanted to form my own theories, I wanted to explore my own way of looking at many of the training improvement issues. So if I keep reading books, I could be influenced by them. So I generally, last 10 years or so, I have not been reading much chess literature, but I've been following the topics that are covered in the books, the authors, and once in a while I read few paragraphs to get an idea what they are talking about. And I have spoken with my students on what books they learn, work on. So that was one of the sources where I suggested these books. But I myself have not worked on these books. Okay, Judith Polgar's books, they are quite
fantastic,
good as well. Yeah, and I can see like there are many old books that are being reprinted, like Endgame Strategy, Shershovsky. Yeah. So these books are also should be good. All the classics I would strongly recommend. In general, I have seen both Quality Chess and New In Chess. Their books are generally very high quality, and also Thinkers Publishing. These three I have been following, at least the topics and the authors, quite regularly. They're coming up with great books. But I have not studied Silicon Road to Chess Improvement, but I heard from Prague it was pretty decent, pretty good.
So is Prague reading a lot of chess books?
He not a lot, because he's working a lot on his openings and his issues, and in general, like, I give him positions and he solves. So in middle game and end game, that's how the training largely goes. And he's also part of Vishy Anand's Chess Academy. It's currently online, where grandmasters Yusupov, Sandeep Anchanda, and Gajewski, they are training Nihal Sarin, Arjun Erigesi, Gukesh, Prague, Ronak, and all these youngsters. They have been part of Vishyanand Chess Academy in the last 1.5 years. Since January last, it's happening every week. The lessons are happening. And that has been largely one of the factors why all these players are making rapid progress.
Amazing. All right. Well, Ramesh, you've been very generous with your time. I know you're an extremely busy man, and you're going to be seeing some of these players you just mentioned tomorrow. So I want to thank you. The book is called Improve Your Chess Calculation. Definitely recommend it. It'll keep you busy for a long time. I managed to read it, but it's one of these books where now I have to go back and actually do it because there's a lot to do in there, and I could certainly use the work. So Ramesh, thanks as always. Congratulations on your success, and we're all looking forward to watching the Olympiad in Chennai coming up in about a month.
Yeah, thank you, Ben, for the opportunity to interact with your audience. You've been doing a great job yourself interviewing players, authors, coaches, and adult improvers, everyone who is interested in the game. You've been doing a great service for the popularity of the game. Really, thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Ramesh.
Thank you.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. Big shout out to my producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank the Blue Wire Podcast Network, with whom we are proud to be affiliated. Be sure to follow us on social media, Beneficial1 on Twitter, at Perpetual Chess on Instagram, or you can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group. You can email me, ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, last but not least, I'd like to give major thanks to the Perpetual Chess Patreon and PayPal supporters. Those who choose to join that community based on their level of support can do things like submit questions for guests of the show, have access to live Zoom Q&A lectures with grandmasters who often have appeared on the show, going over chess games, answering questions, stuff like that. And you can even get access to ad-free Perpetual Chess if that's your preference. So, but most of all, thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you all on the next episode.
Podcast Network.